I want to mention a couple of other passages, and I'm going to come back and I want to talk about Matthew chapter 12 for a little bit. Not because it is just saturated with questions, but I was talking to someone here in the last couple of days about this, and I spent some time on this at home in doing this series of studies. And this is when the disciples are marching through the grain field. So we'll come to that in just a minute. But what happens in Matthew chapter 12, where that comes up, Jesus uses the statement, "Have you not read what David did?" So we're going to come back to that. And we're going to talk about the Sadducees. It seems that there is only one recording of Jesus' direct interaction with the Sadducees. I'm confident there were many others. And that's about the resurrection in Matthew chapter 22, for example. And in the midst of that, you remember they have this scenario, a man who marries, and he makes reference to the Levirate law, the law of the brother. He takes them. Seven men had her as a wife. There were no children. Now she finally dies in a resurrection. And they're trying to give an argument that nobody can answer, that they think proves their point. But what Jesus says, "Have you not read?" Later, and we're going to come to this tomorrow probably, in Matthew chapter 22, after some questions and things come about, I'm going to look at a linking of passages together tomorrow in regard to this. Jesus asked the question, "The Christ, whose son is he?" And of course, they know the answer to that. They know the answer to that in their sleep. David's. They knew 2 Samuel 7, many other passages. And so then Jesus goes to Psalm 110 and says, "Well, how does he call him his Lord? Have you not read?" In that text. Where I want to go sort of at this moment with this, that's always a good place to go. When you're interacting with people, you know, what do the scriptures say? Have you ever read this text? Let's go over and look at that. Don't comment on it. Read it. Now, what's that say? That is always safe ground and fair haven, a good place to be anchored. It is written. And so Jesus does that multiple times. We'll come to this in just a minute. Matthew chapter 19 and verse 4. Someone was talking about Matthew 19 in the last day or so. And is it lawful to put your wife away for just any reason or just every cause? And Jesus says, "Have you not read? He who created them from the beginning." Now, of course, much of the time when you hear this statement, he's talking to Jewish leaders, scribes and Pharisees, and they prided themselves, and we know the text. We know what's written. But what Jesus does is he comes to this text that they should know, and he brings to focus, this is what is written. Now, how does that apply to where we're at this moment? That takes the focus off of you think, I think, to what God says. That's a critical issue. When I was a younger man, first time I went to India, I'm with a guy named Bill Raymer, and he was much experienced of that. I was inexperienced, but we went to a place, Guntertown, and we were talking with a guy, George, trying to persuade him. He was involved with denominationalism, and I think maybe it was a Lutheran, I forget exactly now. It's been so many years. But, you know, he would talk about, well, you know, if I do this, you know, then I don't have this burial plot down here that they provide, and I don't have access to this well. And what was happening, Bill and this fella, they were just going back and forth and back and forth. So they stopped for a minute and said, let me ask you a question, my friend. He said, if this is what's written in God's Word and what God said, is that what you want to do? He said, well, yeah. So we read a passage. He said, well, that is right. He obeyed the gospel. And the church at Guntertown ended up meeting at his home. And that's where the church flourished from that point. But you have to get to that point It's not just a sparring back and forth, you think, I think. It's not, as I said, a mental chess game. That's not what we're after. What is the will of God? And where you get that is not out here or off your bookshelf. It's right here. My friend Gary Sandusky, I picked this up from, been using it for years. He said, put your finger on the passage. When I'm talking to people to have studies, I say, if we study together, my responsibility would be, if I say God says, I need to be able to put my finger on the passage so you can read it. And your responsibility, if I say God says, you make me put my finger on the passage. Because it really doesn't matter what you say or I say or what you think or I think. It matters what God says. Somebody mentioned that, I think, yesterday in their comments. We'll come back to that a little bit later. Let's go back to Matthew chapter 12. And I'm sort of in deep water here time-wise. This is a challenging text in Matthew chapter 12. And there was a guy in 1966, Joseph Fletcher, who wrote a book called Situation Ethics. And it had a significant impact. And of course, you know, many things are driven by humanist manifesto and all that was associated with that. But religious people take this, and what situation ethics meant is you just make a decision by the circumstances to figure out what is right. And it was a very dangerous doctrine. But the type of a passage that would be used by folks that are thinking that way, one of those would be Matthew chapter 12. And in Matthew chapter 12, this is on the Sabbath day in verse 1. And I'm just going to go ahead and read this. I'd have somebody read it, but I'm pressed time-wise. At that time, Jesus went on the Sabbath through the grain fields, and his disciples became hungry and began to pick heads of grain and eat. But when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, "Behold, your disciples do what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath." He said to them, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry? He and his companions, and he entered into the house of God, and they ate the consecrated bread, which is not lawful for him to eat, nor for those with him, but for the priest alone. Or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priest in the temple break the Sabbath and are innocent? But I say to you that someone greater than the temple is here. But if you had known what this means, 'I desire compassion and not sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the innocent. For the Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath." Now, the next verses really just unfold beyond this. He is departing from the synagogue, and they're wanting to know, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? And he says, what man, in verse 11, if you have a sheep falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will not take hold of it and lift him out? Verse 12, of how much more value then is a man than a sheep? So then it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. Now, the argument goes something like this. David was in a tight spot as he was fleeing from Saul, and so he ate bread that was unlawful for him to eat on this occasion. And therefore, when we're in a pinch or things are difficult, we can do whatever we need to do at the time and ignore the law. I mean, that's basically what it says. So unpack this passage for me. How do you deal with that? And is that the argument that's made here?
Jesus calls his disciples innocent.
Innocent. Okay. You look in this text and you see that his disciples are called innocent. Is there anybody else called innocent in here? Verse 5.
Priest.
The priest. What are they doing? They're not just working. They're working on the Sabbath. Yeah. Let me read this to you. Maybe you've not thought about this before. This came from J.W. McGarvey's Fourfold Gospel. And what he does is he talks here about the the work that the priest did. And he just makes some comments here concisely. He says, concerning this matter of sacred food, to direct argument concerning the sacred day. The Sabbath was the busiest day in the week for the priest. They baked and changed the showbread. They performed sabbatical sacrifices. And he's got passages here. Two lambs were killed, and the Sabbath, in addition to the daily sacrifice. This involved the killing, skinning, and cleaning of animals, and the building of the fire to consume the sacrifice. They also trimmed the gold lamps, burned incense, performed various other duties. This profaning of the Sabbath, however, was not real, but merely apparent. Jesus cites this priestly work to prove that the sabbatical prohibition was not universal, and hence might not include what the disciples had done. The fourth commandment did not forbid labor absolutely, but labor for worldly gain. Activity in the work of God was both allowed and commanded. Now, the point of reading that is most of us haven't even thought about what the priests do on the Sabbath day. I mean, they are working, if you would, from early till late. It's their busiest day of the week. But what does verse 5 say about them? Have you not read in the law? This is what the law said. They do all this work, and they're innocent. They are not profaning the Sabbath. Now, the question, why are they not profaning the Sabbath?
God allowed them to do that. God told them.
God directed. This is what you do. That's at the heart of this. This is God's will. What would God have? He gave them this direction. Yes, sir?
Profaning something means to make it common, not holy. But the priest's work, by definition, is to make that day holy.
Okay. Okay, that's right. Okay. Well, let's go back to the disciples then. Here they are plucking grain. They are not priests in that way. And they are grabbing this grain and eating it. And the Jewish leaders have a real problem with that. So what about that? Is it okay or not? Ken?
I'm not sure exactly where your line of thinking is going here, but they didn't sin. They're not out harvesting their fields. You know, they're just eating, you know. So if they were sitting at home and they had to reach down to the plate and pick up food and put it in their mouth, what's the difference if they pull it right off the plant to put it in their mouth? They haven't done anything wrong.
Okay, that's exactly right. They have not violated that. In Deuteronomy 23:25, it talks about as Moses instructs you, come into the land. If you go into your neighbor's vineyard, you can take grapes and eat your fill, but you cannot put any in a basket. The next verse, he says, you can take hands of grain and eat it, but you cannot put a sickle to it. There's a distinction between that and harvesting, is the point. And the disciples here are not breaking the law. They are not harvesting. They're not really doing any significant work at all. And yet they're condemning them. Well, what about this matter of David?
He did something that the law did not allow.
Okay.
And Jesus says it was unlawful for him to do it.
So did David sin, apparently?
I think
David sinned. I think he did what was wrong. But so why does Jesus bring that up? You might say, well,
I've always seen it as you have no problem with what David did, which was obviously a sin, and here are people doing.
That's exactly right.
It's not even a sin, and you've got a problem with it.
I think that's exactly right. He says, look, you justified David. I mean, he did something that was clearly not right.
He's their hero.
He's their hero. And my disciples have done nothing wrong. You're just, pardon my expression, you're just nitpicking. You're just looking for something. And they are inconsistent with this, as we've already read. You know, if you got a sheep, you're going to get him out of the ditch. You're going to feed him. You're going to do that. By the way, they came to the synagogue on the Sabbath day. How do you get there? Beam me up, Scotty. They walked to the synagogue. So as you look at this, this does not prove what people would like it to. And we need to understand this. And Jesus is showing the innocence of his disciples, the innocence of the priests. And you notice this statement in verse 7. This is a critical statement. But if you had known what this means, I desire compassion and not sacrifice, you would have not condemned the innocent. They were hungry. They had a need. And so they ate. This comes from Hosea chapter 6, verse 6. It's used also back in chapter 9 when Jesus says it's not the healthy that need the physician, but the sick. If you had known, you need to go read this passage. And mercy is shown. And so he is showing this. Now, let me ask another question. Jesus mentions in here, I'm the Lord of the Sabbath. So did Jesus dismiss the Sabbath in this text? I'm the boss man here, and I made the Sabbath, and so the Sabbath is insignificant. Brent?
Yeah, I think of this as kind of making clear how much of a missed opportunity Jesus being on earth was, because I think the rabbis had like a 400-page document trying over generations to tease out what the Sabbath required or didn't require and arguing about it.
Okay.
And there was God with them, who was the author of the Sabbath.
Exactly right.
Who could have answered every single question, eliminated, if they could accept his authority, eliminated all the disputes or disagreements or bitter feelings that people might have about, you know, what that matters about the Sabbath. But they didn't ask him. They denied his authority.
Okay, that's right. And when he was the Lord, he knows exactly what the Sabbath is about. Jesus lived without sin. What was a Jew to do under the law? Keep the Sabbath. And Jesus did. Okay, question?
Isn't he sort of saying, I'm the Lord of the Sabbath, so I really know what this is about and what it's not about.
Yeah. So, I think that's what Brent was saying. Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. And here's the proper interpretation and the use of this. So let me ask a question and then whatever we got here. So how does that apply? If I see a situation where I think, I'd like to do this instead of keep what God said, well, it's okay because I feel that way. Not at all. But what about if I'm driving to Sunday services and there's a car wreck and there's a child that's laying here bleeding to death and I stop and take care of it and I miss worship? Yeah, you show mercy there. Okay. So how do you make that determination? Here's my expression. This is a simple way to do it. What would please God in the situation? That's the rule of thumb here. In this case, that baby bleeding, the Lord would have me, I believe, stop and show. It's not about what I want and my direction. It's about what would God want. Okay.
I think, there's a couple of things that I get from that. Number one is just the overall attitude of love for people affects how you interpret the scripture.
Okay.
And if you don't love them, you will see sinners where there are not. And I think that's what happened with the Pharisees, is they saw sinners where there were not sinners.
Okay.
And that's, I think, part of it. You have compassion. They had compassion for David. And in fact, in that case, they saw innocent where there was a sinner, which is also a problem. But in the case of the priest, they were able to reconcile and say, well, of course the priest is not sinning because God told them to do that. And I think if we care about people, we want to reconcile, and so you have motivation. But here, their motivation is condemnation. Okay, well, then that's what you're going to see.
Okay, very good.
But then the other thing, I think, is just the nature of these laws. You know, some people would look at this and say, obviously, it's okay to set aside God's law, and that's what you're getting at. But I do think there's a sense in which we can learn, as preachers and as people who often lead worship, that there is a required sacrifice in that. So maybe you're presiding over the Lord's Supper, you're passing plates around or something, and that requires a degree of focus. And I've heard people say, well, we've got guys in our AV booth, and they say, sometimes I don't get to pay as much attention. And I say, that's right. you are sacrificing the level of your attention in order to provide for everybody else in the room. Yeah. And if they don't give that attention to what they're doing, then now everybody's distracted. And so the same thing as you're passing the plates and so forth, you focus on that job. The priests had to sacrifice, you know, the participants of worship got to show up and sort of enjoy the work of the priest. And the priests did not get that same privilege.
Sure. Yeah.
And so they had to sort of sacrifice this moment that God gave them in order to provide for other people to appreciate it.
Okay, appreciate that. And the day associated with it. Marshall?
And people will try to make a false distinction to put us on the defensive whenever we try to interpret it the way we just did. That they'll suggest, they'll use like some kind of bumper sticker theology that'll say, love always triumphs over law. And what they're not realizing is that by using like the example of helping the child that's dying, it's not that you're setting aside the law of God. You're still
fulfilling
an even yeah. more immediate and greater law at that moment. And so those kinds of things, I think, destabilize people's minds when
yeah.
they'll just say, well, love triumphs over law. Well, what do you mean by that?
I do what I want to do. Yeah. That's what I mean. Yeah. That's what I really mean by that. Yeah.
What are the implications of this? It seems like the parallel he's making is between the priests in the temple and the disciples of Jesus. And the implication doesn't seem to be that they are working with me and they are doing the work that I've authorized them to do and everything that goes with that. This is never a question of putting aside what God says in the law is what I do. It's always which part of God's law, which part of God's work needs to be present in this given moment.
That's okay. All right. Appreciate that. Anything else? Sean?
I think this really highlights the main problem with Phariseeism. The main problem, in my opinion, was not that they were trying to be exact in their obedience to the law of God. It was that they missed the whole picture of the purpose behind many of the laws.
Okay.
And that in fact, their traditions oftentimes would be contrary to the law of God. And that was what the problem was for them, and they couldn't see past their traditions. They were blinded by that.
Okay.
Exactness, you know, Jesus says, I mean, do what they do, don't do what they are their traditions. And so, I think that's something that we need to step back, because I hear a lot of people whenever we're preaching or teaching Bible classes, we get on to the Pharisees for their exactness, their rigidness. And I don't think that was necessarily what was wrong. I think that they were distorting and twisting, and they missed the purposes and intents of God's law.
Okay. If I understand, and many in here probably more knowledgeable about this than I am, what the Pharisees started to do was sort of honorable. We don't want people to leave the law, and so let's build these safeties. But those safeties then became authority and tradition and ended up trumping law in their mind. And in Matthew 15, Mark 7, you set aside the commands of God because of your tradition. That Jesus says that's vain worship. And so that's critical. A couple passages in Matthew 23:23. You tithe mint, anise, and cumin, but you leave undone the weightier matters of the law. You should have done these weightier matters and not left these other matters undone. And so a genuine and a noble adherence to the law of God is commendable, all of it, every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. But it is upon the foundation of justice and mercy, God's revelation, and really in this passage, it's on the foundation of this love for God and love for man, and the mercy that's shown here is at the heart and the core of what God's revelation was. He prescribed how that plays out, and that's what they are to follow, and mercy here brought them to a need. In Luke chapter 17 and verse 10, the disciples ask earlier, Lord, increase our faith. And I'd like you to note this passage. In Luke 17:10, Lord, increase our faith. So he doesn't unleash, you know, a long narrative about that. But he tells them, if you have faith, you know, you'll be able to move mountains. And he talks about a man who has a servant. The servant goes out and works all day. He comes in. He doesn't sit down and say, I've had a hard day, master. You know, take care of me. No, he takes care of his master's needs and then eats. In verse 10, Jesus tells the disciples, after you have done all that I have commanded you, that's what you are to do. You understand that you're still needy servants. You need mercy. You need help. And so that shows the keeping, the wholehearted keeping of what God said. But it's on the basis of grace and mercy. All that you can do in keeping commands will not earn you that. That's a powerful passage. You need to remember that one. Anything else before we move on here? So I'm spending time on this. There are questions here. That's what led us to this chapter. Have you not read? And so Jesus uses that question here and many other things that are here. But the other thing he says, it is lawful to do good. It's lawful to do what God would have done on the Sabbath. And again, what many people want to do with this is they want to undo the law of God and just do what they think, what they feel, what they want. That is contrary to what we see unfolding in the scriptures here. Okay. Again, you can see that, as we mentioned yesterday, the microscope that Jesus and the disciples are under here as they make this particular attack. And as you look in Mark's account and in Luke's account, it talks about the same event. But in Luke chapter 6, and it goes on as he leaves the synagogue, we notice there. And in Luke's account, then it goes ahead and talks about the scribes and the Pharisees are watching him closely to see if he healed on the Sabbath so that they might find reason to accuse him. But he knew what they were thinking. And this goes along with this parallel passage in Mark chapter 3 we talked about yesterday when Jesus became angry. We got some parallel accounts. He knew what was going on. And so he was trying to confront that. So he does that in a most powerful way. All right. So did you never read? So that's one thing. Again, that is always a safe haven. You tattoo that in your brain. This is the question. What is written? What has God expressed? What is His will? Put your finger on it. Take people there. And again, that's what you're trying to do. You're not trying to win them to you or your prowess. You're trying to get them to see this is what God said. Read that. Oftentimes I go to a pastor and say, I don't want to make any comments about this. I want you to read this. And I want this to impact you. And then we can talk about it. What is written? In Matthew chapter 19 and verse 4, where Jesus is asked about marriage, can we put our wives away for just any matter at all? Jesus says, have you not read? The next little nuance here I want to go to, sort of segue into this, to use a term that JR used to use all the time. I'd like to segue. That's where I really become familiar with that term years ago. But to segue from Matthew chapter 19, where it talks about, have you not read? Jesus answers questions with questions. Why do that?
Because oftentimes the one asking the question already has the answer.
Okay. Sometimes the one asking the question already has the answer. At least they have the information. The light may not have come on that they had the answer.
I think it was mentioned yesterday. You're putting them on the defense. You're making them defend what they're asking. And if something's a loaded question, that's the best way to disarm yourself
or
protect yourself.
Okay.
Because you just put it on them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Jake?
Kind of going back to what Jesus, we know that he knew their thoughts. Well, how do you know one's thoughts unless they tell you? And so when you ask a question, a lot of times, like what you said, we end up getting into this kind of
You say, I say.
Match and we're not getting down into their presupposition, what their foundation is, so we're just wasting our time. So asking questions a lot of times, especially the way Jesus asks questions, it gets to what their fundamental thought and heart is behind everything. And that's really what we're trying to know, is what are they actually thinking, not what are their conclusions about things.
Okay, very good. Brent?
So answering a question with the question sometimes gives an opportunity to, I guess, demonstrate maybe what question they should have asked.
Oh, that's good. That's very good.
They did ask. Okay. I think when we were talking about Matthew 24, that kind of came up in that discussion.
Yeah, very, very good. A learned friend had died a couple years ago. I heard him say in a lesson one time, says, people are asking just a lot of questions about a lot of stuff that just doesn't amount to a whole lot. We get distracted in asking all these questions and chasing these rabbits, and that's not really important. You know, you want to know a really important question? Sirs, what must I do to be saved? Now, that's critical. And so to Brent's point, you know, here, I see some more hands. Yep, Adam.
Well, I mean, this question of Jesus in particular, this type of question, have you not read, is an implied rebuke.
Okay, yeah.
But it makes it a little bit more palatable.
Okay. So what happens? Jesus says, have you not read? And then he says, from the beginning he made them male and female. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother, cleave to his wife, be yoked to her. They become one flesh. So how do the Pharisees respond to that?
Well, of course I've read that.
Well, but you're right. They got that. But what else do they do? Yeah, it is written. Yeah, Deuteronomy 21. It is written. And so Jesus responds to that. He says, well, yeah, Moses wrote that. I think at the heart of Deuteronomy 24, I think it's not a license just to divorce your wife for any cause. They were already divorcing. I think that there's some mercy shown to the women there. But at the heart of that, what that says, if you do this, you give her a writ of divorce, it's over. This woman will never be yours again. If this man that she marries afterwards says, hey, I don't like her either, and he puts her away, you cannot have her back. If he dies, you cannot have her back. What you're doing is not good. It's not God's intention. And you need to understand that. And so, but they had turned that in, and I know there's Shammai and Hillel and all the ramifications that go with that. And really, I think that's at the heart of what they're doing. They're testing Jesus again here and saying, man, this is a hot topic, and it doesn't matter. Whichever way you go, you're in trouble, buddy. We got you. But how does Jesus deal with that? What is written? I mean, not that Jesus needed to do this, or nor was his purpose, but it really takes the heat off of him right now and says, what has the Father said? That's where I want my discussions to be. What has my God said? Okay. And of course, you know, he says in verse 9, this matter of sexual immorality is the issue. Now, some of you guys can maybe help me with this later, but I didn't realize it for a while. But in verse 10, when the disciples get to the point, but they say, if this the case with the man and the woman is this way, the word case there is the same word that's used in verse 3. Can we put her away for any cause? And then they say, if this cause matter is only this, man, it's better not to marry. And I didn't realize, but that basically it's the same word in those two places. Would you understand that is a valid?
I have to look at it.
Okay, but that's no. I think that's noteworthy. It connects us even further. They get it. What is the cause? She's yours, buddy. You said I do. When I taught yesterday in your lesson, I've been telling people for lots of years, you need to think carefully about who you marry. Because once you say, I do, you did. She's yours. That's so. I wish I had time for another sermon. I was with my granddaughter Sarah the other day. We were coming back from worship and we were talking about the parable of sower. I said, man, that'd make a great lesson about who am I going to marry. You don't just marry someone that says, oh yeah, I'm going to follow Christ. You find someone that's planted in good soil, and you want to know that's who they are. That's the kind of person you marry. Many a person has seen seed thrown on the ground, and they married that person, they found out there was rock there. Okay. Anything else? All right. So he asked questions, and he answers questions with questions. You remember, and this is one of the most familiar, probably for me at least, in Matthew chapter 21, verse 23, they're trying to trap Jesus. He has cleansed the temple. Of course, Jesus ran the money changers out twice. Sometimes we don't realize that. But in John's account, early at the beginning of his ministry, he turned the tables over, he ran the money changers out. But at the end of his ministry, he does it again. They didn't get it the first time. They just kept doing what they were doing. And so he does that again. And then what we find is they come to him and say, by what authority do you do these things? And of course, they are trying to, again, entrap him. Again and again, we see that. And so Jesus answers their question. I do it by God's authority. Is that what he says? How does Jesus answer their question?
With a very loaded question.
It's a good question.
Yes.
But it is a loaded question. Why is it a loaded question?
Because he knows their hearts. He knows
okay.
their corruption. That's why he's
okay.
not going to answer.
Okay, he knows. And so what's the problem?
Well, the way that he asked about John's baptism and the their answer to that question, their non-answer to that question indicates they're not really serious about the truth.
That's right.
And if they would answer that question, it would answer their question.
That's exactly.
If they would say, John wasn't from heaven, well then that gives you your answer about we're not, you know, I'm taking my own authority here.
Okay.
If they say John is from heaven, well, he pointed to me.
Yeah, that's right. If John's baptism, is it from heaven or is it from men? So we talk about the two sources of authority, and that's an absolute perfect use of that text. But in this, he asked the question because they're not concerned about really obeying God. And other passages show us that. The sinners and the publicans, they responded to John's baptism. They obeyed. But the Jews, even after seeing this, they didn't repent and do it. God's purpose for them was this baptism, he says. Well, here they're not doing that, and they know that. And so he asked this question, if they say that John's baptism is from heaven, then he's going to say, why did you not do it then? You say you believe God and you're obeying God? If this is from God, why did you not do it? They can't go that way. And if we say, well, John's not really a prophet of God, the multitude will have our heads. So we can't answer. So why does Jesus ask the question that way? Number one. And number two, remember yesterday, and I want you to remember this. It's not just a couple of folks here. Here is a multitude of people that are hearing these interactions. Now, they won't say John's baptism is from God. They won't answer this. Where does that put them in the midst of this honorable question? The crowd can see. Stephen?
Yeah, I really think this particular, you know, a lot of the questions Jesus asks, have we not read, that's the people who are religiously knowledgeable.
That's right.
Claim to be. And of course, this is also people who claim that, but I think this is a situation we find ourselves a lot more in. It's a gospel question. That's the world we're in right now. People
right.
love gospel moments. They're
right.
sunlight. And what Jesus does is ask the question that determines whether or not we're having an honest conversation. But Jesus knows they're not. But as you said, the people around don't necessarily know that. And so a lot of times it can be online. I mean, that's our public arena, right? So somebody asks that gotcha question maybe on your Facebook page. Instead of just coming back at them, you can say, well, let me ask this. And you can determine whether or not you're having an honest conversation or not
yeah.
by how they respond to that. If they're just trying to put you in a tough spot, well, okay, are you really wanting a conversation or are you just wanting to make this look bad?
Right. That's very, very good observation. Okay. Tommy?
Real quick word describing everything we're saying. Jesus exposed them.
Okay. Yep. He does. He does. Okay. Anything else there?
And then it's okay if it's determined that they're not being honest, then it's okay to say, okay, I'm not going to.
Yeah, and there's some examples here where Jesus just left them after this.
I'm not going to get involved in this.
Yeah. And there's some couple examples where Jesus just, after that, he asked this question, they just went away. He went away.
You're almost throwing your pearl before the swine. So.
That's exactly right. Okay. Well, I have a minute left. Jesus used questions to blunt attacks like we're really just talking about here. I'll not talk about Nicodemus, but over in John chapter 3, you see the interactions and the questions that are there. Are you a teacher of Israel and don't understand these things? Man, I'd hate to have been in his shoes at that moment. But I think about myself, and sometimes I'm ashamed. I'm not at a better place than I am. I should have figured this out by now. But the Lord is patient, and so I just keep working at it. The Samaritan woman in John chapter 4, how is it that you ask me, a Samaritan or a woman, these things? And Jesus is able to use that interaction and questions there to open the door to state further truths. Last thing here, and then I'll have to stop. And this sort of goes a little bit counter to what I've already said and what we talked about earlier and what I told you that I do at the flea market. A number of times the question is asked, well, what do you think? Remember I said, it doesn't matter what I think or what you think, it matters what God says. But in Matthew 17:25, Jesus talking to Peter says, what do you think? Do the king's sons pay tax to the king? In chapter 18, verse 12, any man had 100 sheep and one goes astray. What do you think? What would he do? 21:28, a man had two sons, which we'll come to tomorrow. What do you think? So a number of times. But here's what I want you to understand or to notice about this. When he asked these questions, the answer, number one, is obvious. This is just a thought question. Okay, get your brain engaged. Chapter 22, verse 17, Jesus asked, is it lawful to pay taxes? And so he is asked that. What do you think? Is it lawful to pay taxes? So they're using that. In this discussion, they're just talking about, okay, let's get our brain engaged into what do the scriptures say? Now, it does matter what you think that way. What do you think the scripture said about this? Well, it says this. This is obvious what one would do. And so we use it in that way, but that is not the basis on which we determine truth. That's the point. That's my point at the flea market. And that's your point, whoever made that. That's not the basis. We've got to engage our brains. And so many times we see that. Jesus asked the disciples, what are you discussing? And they're all sheepish because they're discussing what? Who's the greatest? Who's the big dog here? I would not like to have been in that crowd when that question was asked. But Jesus does that, and boy, it brings things to a sharp point, doesn't it? Okay. All right. I've got to stop there. Many other things, questions are asked to engage and instill faith, like with Bartimaeus, what would you have of me? I want to receive my sight. Questions are used in many ways that way. Again, other things to think about. All right, I've got to stop there. Thank you so much. Anything else before we close? Again, what we're doing is whetting your appetite. When you're studying these books, and by the way, you study the writings of Paul. Notice the questions there too. And so we're just narrowing this down to a particular area to plant some seed. So may you water it and fertilize it, and may it grow and be fruitful to God's glory. Thank you. Hey, bro. Thank you. Hey, Tommy? Your battery may be dead. I'm not sure. It started counting, but when I was done, that's what it looked like.
Yeah. It could be. There's no telling.
If you need, this has a USB. If you got a way to dump it, you're welcome to.
Yeah, okay.
To it. Oops.
I mean, this, yeah.
Or.